politics is a pile of shit.
My
pile
Uzi weigh a ton, I bought it.
I'm getting real close now, smelling it.
My
smelling
Uzi weigh a ton, I bought it.
Welcome to a very, very special edition of Uncle Bobby's Country Corner. I was deep in thought as I was listening to a song from The God Box that came out May 13th by David Banner. The name of that song is My Uzi Weighs a Ton About It. And I thought about that song in light of what has been going on just recently, but we're not going to delve too deeply in that. And before I go any further, I'd like to welcome my very special guest, the one and only Jason Whitlock from Fox Sports. How you doing this morning?
Hello, Bobby. Welcome. Thank you for having me. Happy Sunday.
It is Sunday morning. Yeah. And as Bill Withers would say, the good folks just got up while the folks just came in from the party. So I don't know which one you is.
I was in bed by 10 last night, Bob.
Why?
What do you mean, why?
Why? Why?
Because I'm 50 and I was tired.
Have you actually turned 50?
Yeah.
The big 5-0, man. Well, that's an interesting age to be at. You're not old enough to be old, and you're too old to be young.
Yeah, definitely too old to be young.
So let's just get into it, man. There's been so many things going on, from the continuing reality show known as the presidency of one Donald Trump. And one of the side effects of it, at least according to some people, is that what happened in Charlotte, North Carolina, is connected to some of the makings of President Trump.
Well, I'm still in the information gathering mode as it relates to what happened in Charlottesville. I was busy yesterday working throughout most of the day. I'm writing a piece for the Wall Street Journal and doing some additional reporting and writing and massage. And so I didn't have my TV on all day. And then 3-4, I can't remember, sometime in the afternoon, I looked up on Twitter and saw the conversation about what was going on in Charlottesville. And so eventually I turned my TV on, and I turned it to CNN, and I kept trying to get information, trying to get caught up what actually transpired. And I was subjected to, it seemed like an hour or two worth of just opinion. It was all just, well, did Trump say the right thing? Did he blah, blah, blah? And it was just all opinion, and no one ever told me exactly what happened. No one walked me through what. And so I wake up this morning, and I still don't fully have the full story of what happened. And so I'm still in the, still trying to come to grips with what all happened. I don't know the woman that was killed. I never got a name. I never saw a picture. I don't, you know, I've seen a picture of the young man that drove the car, and some little bit of background on him. But, you know, so for right now, I want to be careful. And to be honest with you, I want to be fair, because I know that some people are immediately going to, well, this is a reflection of Donald Trump. And that was something that I thought was very unfair when Barack Obama was president. The other side, when the police were killed in Dallas, or there were riots in Ferguson, people were, oh, well, this is a reflection of President Obama. And so I want to be consistent and fair, because I never was someone that wanted to go there with President Obama. If something bad happened, oh my God, this is on him. And again, look, eventually everything does fall at the head of the president. You sign up for the job. But I just want to be consistent in my outlook and my opinions. And so for right now, and literally, I'm hoping, it's like I called you yesterday, when I first heard about the thing in Charlotte and at Charlottesville.
And I didn't know nothing.
Right. Yeah. And so when I was like, well, damn, Bob's like me. Obviously you were busy with your day, wasn't paying attention to television or Twitter. Right. Right. But anyway, so I'm not, where are you at on your understanding on exactly what transpired?
Well, my understanding is there was a rally, a Klan rally, and here recently, when the Klan has formally had a rally, there's been a counter group out there in the same proximity, and this time it boiled over into a rolling fight, and they showed them out there, you know, thumping both
sides. I saw some highlights.
Okay, and then this young man, and they showed the clip where he just plowed through a crowd of the people who were protesting the Klan rally, and there's a still picture of the brother on the hood of the car that had got hit. So for me, just knowing those set of circumstances and seeing it more than once, in this case it went to a whole nother level with this cat, you know, I guess just feeling this is something he was supposed to do, you know, since things got out of control. Or maybe he left home feeling that way, which surprised me when they immediately charged him with second-degree murder, because it seemed like it has all the conditions for first-degree murder, because you just don't drive a car into a group of people without having thought about doing that. So I think he should have been charged with first-degree murder. So am I rushing to judgment? I'm just looking at the climate. David Duke didn't waste any time saying, you know, we got our guy in office, and this is how we feel about it. We're not going to pretend any longer that we are not proponents of white supremacy. So when you add all those things together, I can't. And then to watch the president read a script, basically, when he discussed that, the elements of that. This was terrorism one way or the other. You can't just pick and choose when you want to call people terrorists. And in this instance, this was a terrorist act, a domestic terrorist act.
Well, Bob, again, I'm only 50. I think you're
63.
Yeah, and so the first thing I did this morning, actually at 5 a.m., because I was woke up thinking about Charlottesville, and the first thing I did was I wanted to think back in history. And again, these are not analogous, what I'm about to say. They're not analogous, but it's what I was feeling this morning. I was like, man, I wonder what Martin Luther King Jr. would say after an event like this. And so the only thing I could think of was the Birmingham church bombings. And so I went and found his eulogy of the four girls in 1963 that were blown up in a church in Birmingham. And again, I don't know the race of the woman that died in Charlottesville. And so anyway, I listened to his 7-8 minute eulogy. And it was pretty powerful. It certainly challenged the system, but also put into context what our reaction should be. But the other thing I thought about is that in that time, there was actually time to reflect and marinate before anybody jumped to a conclusion. And that was one of the things that was happening to me, like over Twitter in real time. It's like, you should have an opinion. You should have an opinion. And again, there's part of me that's a journalist, and there's part of me that's just 50 years old that knows that there's nothing wrong, and actually there's a benefit to taking your time before formulating an opinion, and that there's a benefit to gathering as much information as you can before offering an opinion, because this is a very volatile time we're living in, and I'm looking for people, just for me. I'm a spiritual person. I was raised in the church. Martin Luther King Jr. is his philosophy. His approach is something I still believe in. And so I'm looking for ways to bring us together and things that can be said that would promote understanding and a positive direction. I think that a lot of people are looking for words that will promote more agitation and more confrontation. And again, just as a strategist, as someone who wants to see black people succeed, survive, move forward, I'm not sure if confrontation, or I don't believe confrontation, is a good strategy. I think it's a good martyr suicide strategy. But again, I'm someone, again, I'm raised in the church. You're never going to get that out of me. My grandmother put something in me. And again, I still idolize and look up to Martin Luther King. And so I'm looking for ways to promote understanding and to broaden or expand the black congregation rather than just preach to the choir, the people that are already ardent members of your church. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm just pressing pause. There's nothing wrong with taking 24, 48, 72 hours a week to reflect and think and measure your words in this time, because I see social media causes us to grandstand so much, instantaneously grandstand. We must have a strong opinion right now. And that's not the way that white people operate. And so if you believe you're in a chess match against white supremacists, they're not as reactionary and emotional and instantaneous as we are. They plot and are strategic. And if we're ever going to outsmart them and outmaneuver them, we're going to have to be more strategic and more plotting. So that's what I thought Martin Luther King Jr. and that movement did. They outthought their opponents and were more strategic and thoughtful than their opponents, and it worked. You know, right now I think I'm looking at a lot of people that want to be instantaneous and say and do something that feels good in the moment but doesn't really promote our best long-term interests.
Well, praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. And the reason I feel that way is there's two things in my estimation need to happen. The white people, and there are some white people that are more human than they are white, and I'm blessed to know a few of those. And right now we need to hear very definitively from those types of voices. Even some of the Republican congressmen came out and called it what they know, that this is racially motivated, because it was a Klan rally, number one. And they said, we don't want no part of this. This is wrong, period. But the president of the United States tried to enjoin black folks like we had something to do with this. All right, from the beginning of my life in 1954, there's been a clear line between the races as far as who was the dominant race and who was the subservient race. It's gotten better over my lifetime, and I'm not going to sit here and act like no victim because I don't think like that. What I'm saying to you, Jason, right now is this. For the president of the United States to try to soften this up instead of looking squarely in that camera, not looking at those scripts, and saying, you know what, this is the kind of foolishness that will bring this country to its knees. And I'm not going to stand here as the president of the United States and sign off on this kind of foolishness. Now, for him not to say that while others in his same party are coming hard on this is unacceptable to me, because I know the climate and how we got here. They have pitted poor people against each other. Then they broke them into these other little groups. And this done got that ugly. And if some white people don't start speaking out and saying, look, I'm not with this. And there are white people who feel that way. And now is the time to stand up and speak on it. Meanwhile, my folks have to take responsibility for their self-determination, and in the process show the world that we got a stake here, that we're going to be here, and we're going to do the kind of things that Americans do, protect my rights as a human being and a citizen here by being proactive in solving my own problems. Because at the end of the day, this comes back to the shrinking resources that are available in this country and too many people not having nothing. I looked at that picture of that boy, and I see him all over America, frustrated, disillusioned, easily swayed. He's 20 years old. And he had that look on his face like, I ain't got no woman, I ain't got no money, I'm living with my mama, things ain't looking that good. So when I take a picture of what happened last night, it's a bigger reflection of how this country has been split into these compartments that are very dangerous, and it calls for a time of truth.
Well, as it relates to President Trump, your expectations for him are far higher than my own. I don't have high expectations for him at all. I think he's a reality TV star who has taken advantage of a unique time in American history and has vaulted himself into the White House. And so I see a buffoon who I expect buffoonish, unpresidential reactions from. And so I don't have a lot of energy to waste on what a reality TV star buffoon is going to do. I just don't have high expectations. I'll let you worry about and exert energy wondering what Donald Trump is going to do. I just don't have time for it. My expectations are way too low. As it relates to the young man that has been accused of this crime, I don't have to today, based off a picture, jump to any conclusions about what was going on in his mind or what his motivation is or what he represents. There's going to be he's under arrest. He's charged with second degree murder at the moment. Over the course of time, we'll get a look into his mindset, and I can jump to conclusions after I have more information about him. There is this feeling of everything has to be decided instantaneously, and that's how we make mistakes in this country, both black and white. And so I would caution people not to give in to that. Again, if you really want to compete and outsmart your opponent, you're going to have to be more patient than what we've shown, and more strategic and more logical and calculated in our thoughts and reactions and actions. So, you know, that's where I would stand on that. And that is not clearly, look, man, white supremacy, the KKK, the Nazi movement has been a part of the fabric of America since its outset. What we can focus on as black people is the laws that this country adopts and enforces. I don't think black people, that we will be able to exert any real pressure or influence on how white people feel. I think that's a fruitless, futile endeavor to try to maneuver, influence how white people feel. Trying to influence what laws our government adopts and enforces that protect us, we've got a history of showing, going all the way back to changing the slavery laws, we've had success there. We've had no success in trying to control how white people feel. There is a documented record of you can have success in changing laws and how they're enforced in America. And so I would focus on that. And so I see a lot of us over social media caught up in feelings and caught up in how white people feel about us. Again, I'll go back to, you go back to the 1600s in America, and I just don't think we've been able to exert much influence over how white people feel. And so I would steer us against that.
Well, we're going to agree on the self-determination part, because, you know, you asked the question, what would Martin do? As soon as you said that, I thought about Malcolm. Then I thought about the Deacons of Defense. Then I thought about Fannie Lou Hamer and Ida B. Wells and people that said, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to stay out of your way. We're going to work on, you know, self-determination. But if you cross this line and think that there was never the possibility of me defending my rights to live peacefully by just letting you just slap me around all the time, wait a minute, that ship done sail. Now, and again, that's not a first strike response, but it is a possibility if you just keep crossing that line. And right now, we're up to that point where there's too much happening with impunity in regard to just how our rights are looked at as something that you don't have to take seriously. Again, my personal philosophy is let's intensify addressing the things that we can control, and that is where we live, work, and play, and how we educate our children, and how we interface with people from whatever walk of life that we have common interests with. Because right now I'm dealing with a white gentleman who has more compassion and passion about developing properties in my neighborhood than my own folks do.
Bob, let me suggest this in one difference that I think we can speculate about yesterday's events as opposed to what has transpired in our history. I can't recall the gentleman's name that's been charged with this crime. I don't know the names of any of the people protesting. No, the people protesting. I know that white nationalists, Nazi groups or whatever. If we think back to the 60s, and again, when you start talking about what we can and cannot control, the 60s, law enforcement and the government, from the governor's office, George Wallace, he was using law enforcement and the mayors and the sheriff's department and law enforcement to brutalize and beat us down. They participated. They sicked the dogs. They held the water hoses. They threw the batons. Government officials. Mm-hmm. And then government officials backed the white citizens that were harassing us and protected them. And so what you've said and what I saw on TV yesterday is citizens did something illegal, immoral, reprehensible. The government is coming down on those people. There were black policemen in Charlottesville and just policemen in general that were coming down on the citizens. And so when you ask what a government can do, again, they can't change or they can't, yeah, they can't change the way the gentleman that drove the car or the people that were part of the Nazi groups, but they can penalize them and bring the force of law enforcement and our laws down on these people and punish them. And so I think we should keep some pressure there on the government to exert its power against these people. But I think we have to recognize that as it relates to the local Virginia government, and hell, even going all the way up to Jeff Sessions, I believe he announced, the attorney general announced that there's going to be civil rights investigations as related to this. And so we need to recognize that these are some citizens that did something inappropriate. Our government so far, everybody except for President Trump, seems to be acting properly and in our interest.
And I hope that continues, because you mentioned the 60s, and one of the things that has been underreported about the 60s and the whole time that we've been in this country, there have been African-American, blacks, whatever you want to call them, that were skilled and disciplined in protecting themselves and their communities. There's been other situations like Rosewood and Tulsa, Oklahoma, where things got out of hand and we were subjected to just unspeakable atrocities. But the point I'm making is I would never suggest or recommend a confrontation with the majority community in this country. It would be suicidal to do that. At the same time, our history has shown that when push came to shove, we have been successful in defending some of our territory, like down in Bogalusa, Louisiana, back in the 60s, when the Klan was just really, very active and very powerful. The Deacons of Defense, without a whole lot of hoopla, drawing attention to themselves quietly. The veterans from World War II and the Korean War came together and said, you know what? Enough is enough. And they literally disrobed the Klan in Boca, Louisiana. More importantly, they were the shadow group that protected Martin Luther King when he got tired of getting beat up. A lot of people don't know that. So I'm not encouraging violence, but if there's going to be just complete disregard for our safety like that and people continue to feel that that's going to happen.
First of all, let's as it relates to yesterday, where is the example of the complete disregard for our safety?
Well, I can't use yesterday as an example of that, but just the way that they charge folks, it shows like, wait a minute, how you get second degree murder out of what appears to
it's
be very
early,
clearly
early in the process. Let's see how this plays out, man. It's early. You may be right, but again, it's been less than 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Let them gather the information and let them, you know, make a decision. I don't know, but everybody I saw on TV from the black lieutenant mayor or vice mayor, mm-hmm. everybody that I saw on TV from in Virginia seemed really motivated to do the right thing as it related here, related to this incident. And so let's let it play out. But, you know, when we start talking about the complete disregard for our safety, you know, where my mind goes is, you know, there's far more examples of that within our own community, and the complete disregard of our safety comes down to manufacturing jobs being shipped overseas and our communities being economically ravaged and devastated. The complete disregard for our safety, I look at mass incarceration policies that pull all black men basically out of these communities and emasculate them through the prison system.
Yeah.
Those are the examples of the complete disregard for our safety that I see. And that's why, again, my focus has always been on mass incarceration and the drug war. When you take a man out of his community, put him in a prison system that completely emasculates him, animalizes him and things like that, that's a disregard for the overall welfare of the black community that we should be trying to address. Whereas if you get caught up, in which we are about to get caught up in the KKK, and again, the KKK used to be very powerful and influential in America. It's just, in comparison, it's just not. They're not running around terrorizing us in the night. My great-grandfather was taken out of his house by the KKK. That's why my family left Kentucky and moved up north to Indianapolis, because my grandfather was taken out by the KKK and nearly hanged until he identified himself as a Mason. That's the only thing that saved his life. And so those days just aren't here. And so we're about to, again, run into another one of these booby traps that have been laid for us. We got to stop the KKK. And what we really should still always be focused on is mass incarceration. That's the thing that's really damaging us. And so we're not going to, again, we're about to lose sight on what laws can we push the government to enact that improve our lives and give us more control over our lives and more self-determination. We're about to get caught up in David Duke, who's been around forever. To me, he's like a toy or a piece of candy to distract. He represents nothing all that real. But we get caught up, and we're going to lose focus on what we should really be doing that could improve and enhance our life and give us more determination over our lives, because we're about to go chase. And again, some of this, I'm out on a limb, a little bit out over my skis, because I'm still waiting for a detailed story report on what happened in Charlottesville. How many people were out there? I want a real number, and someone show me how many actual Nazi, KKK, white nationalist protesters were there, and then how many anti-protesters were there. And because I want to know, how big was this? How many people were represented? Was it 50? Was it 150? Was it 200? Because, again, I'm 50, and I don't want to say only 50, but I remember as a kid, and long before there was these cable news channels, these KKK groups and white nationalists, they would have their little rallies.
Mm-hmm.
And the local news stations would cover it, mm-hmm. and that would be that. There wouldn't be a huge anti-protest. There would just, okay, they had a little rally. Now we're going to go on back to business and keep it moving. Now that there's these national cable news outlets who focus on this, on these things, and again, we need to know what the hate groups are doing. They need to be monitored and blah, blah, blah. But we don't need to blow it up as if they're running the country and have this enormous influence that they used to have. because I'm not sure they do. And again, a buddy of mine called me from D.C. yesterday. I was like, oh, I can't believe I live in a time where the KKK is just out parading in broad daylight.
What he mean?
That was exactly what I was like. Hey, man, this has been going on forever. It's never stopped. I said the only thing that's changed is the national cable news outlets now broadcasting because it's good TV for them, and they can have some sort of sensationalized conversation about race. And again, this is like we've gone through this is a new kind of terror alert. Do you remember when George Bush had all the different colors, the
right.
terror alerts?
Right.
Oh my God, they're about to bomb us. We're at threat level orange.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going on here. There's all the KKK is a terror alert. They're about to take over Charlotte or Charlottesville. And I don't think that's true. And I never underestimate my opponent. But I also know when we're being played. And I want to transition into something, because we were supposed to talk about something else. But I want to
transition. It's all connected.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I want to transition into Twitter. Because again, I was being criticized yesterday by Stan Verrett at ESPN. Oh, how come you won't be out? You've got to.
He came at you directly?
Yeah, he came at me directly that I was not speaking out against what happened in Charlottesville. And yes, he was.
Who are you?
and I was. The argument I was making, I was like, hey, man, this is Twitter. There's no revolution.
Wait a minute, you got to give me a minute to digest that. Stan Verrett.
Yeah, at ESPN.
I know who he is. Yeah. He called you out?
Yes, because I was not speaking out against, over Twitter, the events in Charlottesville.
Mm.
And again, I have a totally different philosophy about Twitter than most people. I don't take it seriously. And it's not a serious platform. 140 characters is not enough room
to flesh out anything.
Anything.
Really.
Yeah. It's not the, again, it's a place to virtue signal. But here, I want black people to think about the booby traps that we fall into all the time. I want us to think about, why is there a black Twitter, allegedly?
I've never been on it.
But again, there's this thing called black Twitter.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So if it were a good thing, if it was something new and revolutionary and powerful, do you think there would not be a white Twitter? No. There's nothing called white Twitter.
They don't have to call it white.
No. But again, I'm just going, because here's the history. When there's something good produced by us, the first thing white people do is steal it. If we make a song, a hit, they're gonna come out with one just like it, sound just like it. If anything, we come up with a hairstyle. If we sag our pants, they all start sagging their pants. We put braids in our hair, they're going to braid their hair. Whatever we come up with, they immediately jump on and we got to have ours too. And I just haven't, there's nothing Asian Twitter, there's nothing Muslim Twitter, there's nothing Italian Twitter, there's Mexican Twitter, there's none of those things. That's why I know it's a trap, because again, they want Silicon Valley and the people controlling social media want us to believe that Twitter, this is the headquarter for revolutionary change. This is empowering for black people, because they know it's the dumbest, most substanceless form of communication that humankind has ever invented. And we want black people to think it's their salvation, that it's part of their solution. No one else does. No one else takes Twitter as seriously as we do. And it's a flaw. It's a trap. It's a mistake. It's the dumbest. Again, it keeps you thinking there are instantaneous 140-character solutions to your problems. No one else thinks that way. They think of long-term strategies, substance. They have think tanks. There are white think tanks that write up long reports and long strategies on how we can move forward. We trying to move ahead 140 characters at a time. Good luck.
Well, you know what's interesting about that, what you just said, I'm on Twitter, and I use it just to share points of view and some of the legacy that I'm a part of. And I put out a tweet the other day that got a lot of likes because it was funny. And I said, a woman will panic at the sight of a mouse, but she'll bring a man down big as a house. You got all kind of retweets and likes because, you know, people want to be entertained. But then when I'll put something out that reflects our responsibility to take serious positions about our communities or something like that, I get one or two likes. I used to take it personally, but I'm to the point now where the work that I believe in and I do every day, I finally accepted the fact that it's me and about three other folk, you know.
Well, I would say, Bob, I think it's the wrong platform to put out anything serious, and certainly to expect a serious response to.
Well, that's been borne out, what you just said.
And so, again, that's why I look at Stan Verrett. He at some point, he said to me, I use Twitter to speak my conscience. And I responded back. I was like, anyone who can speak their conscience in 140 characters is breathtakingly shallow. It can't be spoken in 140 characters.
I'm still trying to get over. I see a picture of Stan Verrett looking in the camera all these many years at ESPN where a whole lot of stuff was going on, and he had no opinion on air whatsoever. He just did his job, went about his
business.
He's
speaking his conscience on Twitter, Bob. That's where he goes to challenge the man, is over Twitter. On ESPN, on camera, he reads what they put in the prompter and keeps it moving.
Okay. I guess that's what shocked me when you said he came at you hard like that, you know, because I ain't seen that Stan Verrett.
Listen, when I worked at ESPN, I like Stan Verrett. I think he's talented and funny, love his act, and we worked in the same building and got along. But again, I didn't tweet anything at him. He came at me, and it just crystallized for me My problem with Twitter is that you have all these black celebrities basically conveying to the black masses that Twitter is something we should take seriously. And it's not. Twitter is the little kiddie pool that they've sent us to go play in. Y'all go splash around down there. We over here in the ocean doing real shit. Y'all go splash around down there. And that's what we've been doing. And so, again, I look at, and I know I'm about to irritate people, but I look at LeBron James putting out a message about Charlottesville over Twitter. And I go,
what did he say?
That it's sad what happened there. But he said something about how this president, he said he was going to make America great again. You know, look at this. Something that went directly at Trump. And again, I don't think it's the right lane. It's not the effective lane. Because again, we have, if you want to try to open the minds of a Trump supporter, that's not effective.
Well, you know, you said something earlier about whether or not white people give a shit about what happens to us, and it applies to what you just said now. Less time spent on what white people think and more on what we can do to change our condition. Now, in terms of LeBron is still evolving, in my opinion, and I measure him by, you know, the acts that are real, I think, important with his money. You know, he's putting a lot of money back in black people's hands. So I give him a little more space to complete that circle of maturity.
Of evolution, you know, no question about it.
Whereas other people are far more reactionary, and I don't see any evidence of them helping to solve problems. So when people start talking about protesting and boycotting and all of that, I'm saying, okay, let's look at the history of that. The only time a boycott was ever successful when it came to black people is when it was strategic down in the South, when they said basically, they actually made an offer in Alabama to buy the bus company that they wouldn't even allow them to ride on. And then they organized a way to get around, because that's what it took. Now, other than that, boycotts have had a boomerang effect, because typically when you boycott a company, folks lose their jobs and all that kind of stuff, and you never took that into account. So I'm with you in terms of not being just emotional and step back and say, what's our best practice and who should we be following? Should we be following these folks that have no skin in the game and nothing really to lose if they tell you to go out and do X, Y, and Z, whether it's take up a gun or whatever? If that ain't your thing, then you need to stay out that lane, you see. But there's some practical things that we can do on a daily basis. Like, instead of just running around spending your money all willy-nilly, look at how you can create a flow of an economy while you out here just being mad. Like, in every city right now, there's so much development going on that don't involve us that we have a constitutional right to participate in. And I'm having trouble getting our people to look at the fact that the very thing that you're most concerned about is, and that's the gateway to the middle class, is happening right in front of you right now, and you sitting on the bench watching television and all this kind of stuff.
Let me transition. You've opened up a lane to, because, man, we've gone a lot longer on Charlottesville than I anticipated. But the conversation we planned on having was, and I want to get into in the last 15, 20 minutes here, is we are now in this mindset, a lot of it led by social media and Twitter, where black people are talking about some boycotting the National Football League. And it's non-strategic. It's not well thought out. It's, you know, Spike Lee has promoted some Colin Kaepernick rally in New York at NFL headquarters on August 23rd. And this Colin Kaepernick story is spinning into a story about the National Football League is bad for black people. And I just want everybody, and maybe it is, but let's get into a think tank and really think this thing through before we just jump to this conclusion. Because it's the only industry other than the NBA, but the NFL affects far more people. They have bigger rosters and more employees, that black millionaires are its workforce and base. And so we're about to boycott the one industry where we're having massive success over Colin Kaepernick. And again, I just want to repeat, I'm just saying this factually. I'm not saying it negatively. I'm just saying it factually, and I'm not trying to be offensive. Colin Kaepernick, never a part of the black community. Raised by a white family. He's half black, half white. He's raised by a white family. He now is the person, the symbol that everybody in the black sports world is jumped behind. And I'm just sitting there going, holy cow. This dude is clearly going through an identity crisis and being controlled by his girlfriend. This man is unwilling to speak for himself, but being compared to Muhammad Ali, who never shut his mouth, who was never afraid to confront and address anybody that challenged him. But somehow Colin Kaepernick, with his retweets and Instagram posts, is the new Muhammad Ali. You just talked about the boycott, the Montgomery bus boycott in the 60s, and how we strategically chose Rosa Parks to kick that off and be the symbol of it. There were a bunch of candidates, but civil rights organizers were smart enough, patient enough, thoughtful enough to know, no, we have to strategically pick the perfect person to represent this movement and to be a part of this movement. They just didn't go willy-nilly and say, let's run out to the suburbs and get this black dude that ain't even connected to us. Let's have him be the face of this. He's afraid to even open his mouth, but he's going to be the face of it. They strategically chose Rosa Parks. When we go back to Jackie Robinson, strategically chosen. This wasn't willy-nilly. There was better baseball players. But they chose somebody that could handle the job.
Well, he paid a price. He was premature gray, and he stroked out from all that pressure. And I'm glad you mentioned Jackie Robinson, because that strategy may not work ever again, because it really didn't work then, because you can't ask the man.
How's it really didn't work, Bob?
It didn't work because.
Bob, man, you're just being argumentative.
You think so?
Well, let me. It happened in 47.
Hold on.
And he inspired the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s.
And here we are still replaying the civil rights movement. Well, we still don't have a right to vote.
Bob, quit, man.
The 65 Voting Rights Act, 64
Bob.
Voting Rights
Bob,
Act is
stop.
Still renewed. No, seriously. We still don't have a permanent right to vote.
Okay, I'm sorry. It wasn't the perfect solution,
right.
So therefore it wasn't a solution.
No, gotcha. I ain't saying that.
Right.
I'm not saying that, but sometimes you take it to another
I'm
level.
Not taking it to – it would be like if I lost 50 pounds, you would come in and say, you need to lose 75.
No, I wouldn't, Jason. No, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't, man.
Yes, you would.
I would salute you, man.
This is what you're doing with Jackie Robinson.
No.
Damn it, you should have lost 75.
No, man.
It worked.
No.
Was it the perfect solution? No.
No, absolutely.
Is it something that we should be trying to perfect, replicate, perfect, take to the next level in terms of. Listen, man, that generation, whether we like it or not, more effective, more faithful, better than our generation. I don't care how you slice it.
I agree with that. But here's what I got a problem with. The Koreans, the Japanese, all the people who have come into this country and accelerated and took off did not concentrate on their civil rights. They built an infrastructure that included being able to have their own schools, their own community.
Hey, Bob, I agree with. So I agree with that.
But I'm a Booker T. Washington man in that kind of way.
I agree with that. But you do know that they had a different history.
All of that's true, but we're talking about where we're playing it. We're playing in America, and America only respects ownership.
A different American history they did than us.
I know, but I'm talking about America. The power is rooted in ownership.
There's no question about that.
So if you got any other strategy than ownership, because by ownership, you got a right to defend with your life.
There's no question. You're 100% right. I'm right there with you on Booker T. But don't underestimate or don't. There's lessons to be learned in terms of how non-strategic we are now as opposed to then.
All right, we're going to go there.
That's
agree with
how
you.
Non-strategic.
We don't have a strategy.
None at all. It's all emotion.
Yeah.
It's 1,000% emotion. Everything.
The best example of that, and it's the notion that you can put on a T-shirt that says Black Lives Matter. And that's your agenda. I mean, that's your strategy. And I'm like, that's the most nonsensical thing that I've seen happen in the last 20 years is that you can turn a T-shirt into a movement that goes in a circle to nowhere.
And so, Bob, I'm going to go back to, I'm a one-issue guy and have been for 25, 30 years. This goes back to mass incarceration. You take the black man away from his community, away from his family, put him in a system that emasculates him, makes him less than a man, then dump him back into his community. That's how you get a very unmasculine, very...
A directionless.
Directionless,
community.
But I'm trying to be careful here. No, I know the words, but okay. I'm trying to clean it up. But again,
wait, why are you going
to
clean it up?
Because, listen, man, people hang on my every word. They all act like they hate me, but they hang on every word that comes out of my mouth. It's not masculine, our leadership. It's non-strategic. It's very emotional. And
then it's not working.
It's clearly. And again, I'm telling you, we have a previous generation that we could study and learn from.
You need to add a few more names to that, though, because we keep coming back to Martin Luther King.
I'll go to Malcolm X.
Well, go to H.G. Gaston. Okay.
Because, again, you brought me to my other point. The other thing, again, this week, today I woke up looking at what Martin Luther King said about the Birmingham bus bombings. Earlier in the week, I probably watched 20 times Malcolm X's interview on some college campus in the 60s, where he talked about the difference between the wolf and the fox. And you should really watch this, man. He talks about that the white liberals are the fox and how they chase lamb. And they pretend, they pretend to be the sheep's best friend. And, just love you, sheep. And he goes, and they always end up with lovely lamb chop. Just love. Seasoned to perfection. dude, you got to watch it, because I'm like, this man said this 50 years ago, and it's like we have no idea that this was said and that it's gospel. And that, and he basically said, look, he goes, maybe the white conservative, he's the fox. He's telling you exactly what he wants to do. And basically he was saying, I respect that.
Absolutely.
I can deal with that. And I, again, that's where I come. That's the mentality and the basis I come from. Tell me what the game is, and now let's sit down and play it, because I can play it with you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you, I'm your best friend. We're not playing a game. I'm on your team. I love you to death, blah, blah, blah.
Here's some government cheese.
Yes. And the next thing you know, they done fed me a bunch of cheese and some grain, and I'm big and fat, and it's like, now I'm ready.
And lazy and tired.
Yeah. Now I'm ready to slaughter your ass and feed my whole family. And so, again, man, that's the game we keep falling for, and that's when all of this is connected, this entire conversation. That's what Twitter is to me. It's the fox. The liberal fox is in control of Twitter and is told, Twitter is your friend. We got a special section for y'all called Black Twitter.
Mm.
And y'all just sit down there in 140 characters. Y'all solve the world's problems. Meanwhile, we'll be over here back at our compound with a bunch of scientists and researchers. And we're going to come up with our game plan.
Right, right.
Y'all come up with y'all's game plan right here on Twitter and execute right out in front of everybody. We're going to go plot up our stuff in secret. Again, it's the Fox, man. And we are so in love with liberals and think that they are our salvation and think that their ideology is going to solve all of our problems. And we got an excuse for any and everything they do. If Bill Clinton comes up with three strikes, you're out, and locks up more black men than any president before, it was an accident. He didn't mean to do that. He loves us. Didn't you see him on Arsenio
playing the saxophone?
Yeah, yeah. My God, he loves us.
Yeah.
He's the first black president.
It gets worse, though, because when I mentioned H.G. Gashin, you had this look on your face like, who is he?
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you why that's important.
Right.
It's hard to be something that you don't know about. You've heard me mention Leon Gar, right here in L.A., 103 years old. Mr. Gar told me a long time ago, he said, Bob, I made $1 million before I could spell a me. I said, how'd you do that, Mr. Gar? I said, you want to make money, you got to make friends. We don't know these type of folks that, against all odds, H.G. Gashin down in Alabama, while everybody was thinking that we were just getting run over, was acquiring just as much property. He owned more property than Booker T. Washington did. He had everything that the community needed. And I had a friend that worked with him as a contractor, and he said, we're going to bid on this building over here. He said, man, that's going to cost such amount of money. He said, are you scared to build this building? Because I got the money. We don't know the people that we need to know in our community that are finishers, that are closers. And that's why we are always falling back on that one thing where we'll throw the rock and hide our hand. And that goes for the leadership or the lack of it you was talking about earlier. There's no excuse for us in this present day and age not to know that if you want to be free, you cannot be dumb. And you cannot allow people who are not really the top folks in your community to represent you. And we're coming back to Colin Kaepernick and this whole notion that we should get emotionally and otherwise involved in a scrap between millionaires and billionaires, because it really doesn't have anything to do with our day to day. For me personally, I watched this cat 3 years ago just be, you know, a typical young guy who had all the tats and all of that, and never heard him say anything about social anything. We had all kind of social going on and not a word from Kaepernick. And like you said, all of a sudden, behind an issue that he don't even mention anymore, which is police brutality, it's like, how did that happen? Because in your article in the Wall Street Journal, you spoke about the fact that, wait a minute, what is this all about again?
Well, look, clearly, from the outset, what he did created conversation about Colin Kaepernick and not police brutality. And now here we are 8, 10, 11 months later, and the conversation now is about how evil the NFL is. It's never been about police brutality. That was a ploy and a tactic. And
by who?
Partially, I believe Kaepernick initially, he was so frustrated and embarrassed about losing his job. It was just a fit of anger. I think his girlfriend was actually on the Black Lives Matter deal, and it just became a convenient thing. Once the far left group and again, he's sitting right there in Silicon Valley headquarters, San Francisco, right there in the Bay. Once they recognized the opportunity with Kaepernick, they spun it into something that works for them. Again, they don't like the NFL, the far left. It's a conservative, football is a conservative sport, and it's a conservative cultural force that actually benefits black people. And again, this is why, again, I'll take the wolf every day. The wolf wants to make money. If you can be a part of his economic solution, he don't care. He's down with you. If you stand in his way, he's going to eat you up and run you over. I can deal with a wolf. Because, again, I'm looking at wolves create an industry that, again, football, even if you don't make it to the NFL, you can be somebody like me and go to a mid-American conference, mid-major Division I program, never get a whiff of the NFL, but get plucked out of poverty and put in a position where your eyes get open to all the opportunities that America has and get on a path to build a career,
to an 800 credit score.
Yeah, help your family, help your cousins, help your mama, help your nieces and nephews, help your friends' kids. You can do that because of football. And again, you ain't even got to go to a Ball State. There's junior colleges, community college, Division III schools that you, if you can play football, they'll pluck you up and bring you to this college campus. It's what the military used to do with the draft. You spend 2 years in the military, 4 years, eyes get open, you away from nook-nook in them for a minute, and you start thinking differently, and then they send you home like they said, you know, my father did 2 years in the Army. Before he went to the Army, he got pinched for dealing some dope.
Your dad?
Yeah. And then he goes to the Army, comes back.
Jimmy was something else, wasn't
he? He was real. Then he comes back, he's a different person. Now he see, oh, I'm going to start my own business, have my own shit. Ain't nobody going to tell me what to do. My father was a guy, didn't want to be around nothing but black people, and that's the way he lived his life. And he was happy doing that until he couldn't drink and golf no more and fell over and died. That was his life, and he was satisfied with that. And so I just, if we would just snap out of the liberal haze and start recognizing actually where the opportunities are, it's in self-determination, standing on your own 2 feet, and working with people who are willing to work with you as long as you can stand on your own 2 feet.
And that should be irregardless of color.
Yes, there's no question about it. Yeah. That's why, again, I'm a defender of football. I'm a defender. Again, I don't care if Jerry Jones thinks every perfect thought about black people. Doesn't bother me in the slightest. What I like about Jerry Jones is he'll pay them contracts. He'll defend these guys come hell or high water. Even when they get in a jam, he defends them because they're an asset to him and what he wants to do. And I know a lot of these guys. They love Jerry Jones. He loves them. Is Jerry Jones perfect? Is anybody? I don't know any perfect people. But I know people that aren't bothered by my success. And that tends to be conservative people. Conservative white people are not offended by my success. The people offended by my success have consistently been liberal, white, and black people. Completely offended that I'm successful.
And not a victim.
Yes.
Well, Jason, we've run the hour up. And I kind of want to close the show out consistent with my theme of models of possibility and best practice. So what could you say about where we are right now and what we should be really looking at doing to, I guess, move the needle, man?
Again, I would say in this moment, given the events of yesterday, I would just go back to what I was talking about earlier. Let's not respond emotionally. Let's respond strategically and let's acquire and gather information about what happened in Charlottesville, then take a moment to think and then react. There are no conclusions that have to be reached today that can't be reached tomorrow or the next day when there's more information. There is no, you know, if you tweet out something emotional that makes everybody feel good, it's not going to make any fucking difference. And so I would, again, just, you know, I just keep repeating the same messages and just trying to reshape them, re-spin them, and so maybe one of them will connect. But I just social media and Twitter, it's smallpox and blankets. it's something that, oh, this blanket's going to keep you warm at night, and it's going to kill you come morning. That's what Twitter is. We think it's our salvation. It's a kiddie pool to keep our thoughts dumb and small and not solutions for us. We've been assigned to the kiddie pool, black Twitter. Again, when they start white Twitter or Italian Twitter or Mexican Twitter, that's what I'll believe. Oh, Twitter's a good thing. But as long as we're the only ones with this special title for Twitter, I know it's a trap.
I got to ask you one quick question before we get out of here. I find it interesting that, with a few exceptions, present NFL players who happen to be black have been completely silent about this Colin Kaepernick thing. What's your take on that?
I think many of them are aware of who Kaepernick is. I've talked to or have heard from or have heard about many prominent black athletes who know the deal with Colin Kaepernick, who know he wasn't remotely about black shit until he lost his job and his girlfriend said, you know, join Black Lives Matter and, you know, and we'll take you over to Ghana and we'll grow your hair out and I'll braid your hair up, baby, and I'll show you how to be black. Pull your pants down a little bit. Show the crack of your ass. They'll love it. And so I think many of them know that. Many of them, again, man, when take Jim Brown, man, and again, Jim could have played a bunch of sports, but football provided him an opportunity to do what he does now. Football provided me the opportunity to do what I do now. If you make it in football today and you've signed some massive contract and mama got a new house and your little brother's going to college on your dime and your auntie
got a teeth fixed, you know.
Got a teeth fixed, yeah, yeah. And blah, 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 blah. And grandmama is in the nursing home she needs to be in. Mm-hmm. And you know that, like, football is doing this for you. You're not fitting to go to war with football because you're smart enough to know, like, well, hold on, man. What other job is Chrysler? Is it going to do all these things for me? Is some radio DJ or what other industry is it? And again, is football perfect? Hell no. No industry is. But I just don't think most of them know they're not going to step out here and do that because they're not going to bite the hand that's feeding them. Now, are there the Michael Bennett's and these other guys that have made some money and they want to be popular over Twitter? Because, you know, if you support Colin Kaepernick or you get picture with Colin Kaepernick raising a black fist, you know, that'll get you retweeted and liked over Twitter. There's some guys that just can't resist that. Their personality say, I want to be popular on Twitter. Mm. And so they jump out there and Colin Kaepernick, you know, I love him today. He's soul brother number one.
I can't get excited about that. And the reason is there are too many people around the country, not in terms of a massive number of folk, that are quietly doing the kind of things that will impact far more lives directly than a millionaire arguing with billionaires over an issue that is not really what this whole thing is about. Like you said, at the end of the day, this is about a guy who at one point, when he was really in that spotlight for real, as a starting NFL quarterback, I didn't hear a peep, and we done had enough injustices over the span of his professional career that he could have jumped in the fray a long time ago if that's what his heart was really all about. And I'm not really questioning him evolving as a person. Yeah. I'm just saying, let's don't OJ this situation. Because by that I mean, Black people got emotionally involved with O.J. and not realized as soon as O.J. got out of jail, he started dating a white woman, looked like the one he killed, and just said, you know, everything's wonderful.
Well, we had this conversation, I think, last time I was here, Bob. Again, a lot of what you see going on over Twitter and with a lot of the athletes on TV is they're just doing an act trying to pretend like they're not O.J., mm-hmm. when they really are O.J.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's the greatest cover-up you can do is, you know, if you're dating in the white community, living in the white community, doing business in the white community, but want to pretend like you're Malcolm X, just go out and cape up for Kaepernick or Black Lives Matter and everybody, oh, well, you know, he just happened to fall in love. he just happened to move out there. He just happened to run with that group of friends. Mm. He's really one of us. Did you see what he said about Kaepernick?
You know, as I close out the show today, I take a great deal of pride in getting to know some people close enough to call him a friend. And we don't always agree on things, but...
No, we don't agree on most things.
But one thing I do is I respect what you do as a human being because you pick your, you know, your little causes and whatnot and the things that I know that you do that people don't know because they scratching their head wondering, how is this working between Bobby and Jason? Because Bobby is this and he's that. They are different income groups and all that. And that shit don't matter to me at all, because it's just down to how we respect one another. And I could say the same thing about somebody like David Banner. David Banner is, when you listen to him very carefully, whether he's doing an interview or just going about his business, the one thing I know is the brother puts his money where his mouth is, and he has built an operation that reflects what it is that's in our best interest, and that is if you get your hands on something, share that with another brother, but not just in terms of charity, but in terms of trying to affect change. And we as a people right now really need to look very closely at the folks that we follow. Are they talking the talk and walking the walk? Or are they just sending you that way while they go on about their regular business? So, Jason, thanks again, man, for stopping by Uncle Bobby's Country Corner and continue.
Bob, I think this was our best show. I really do. We've done a bunch. I think this is our best show. Thanks for having me.
Man, it's been a pleasure. All right, we're out of here, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for watching. Yo, Chuck.